Thank you so much for having me here today. I'll give you a brief overview of myself. I live in Perth, where I fellowship at Dream Builders Church, which used to be called Swan City Church, up in the Swan Valley. And I'm married. I've been married for 10 years now, and I have two children, a five-year-old and a two-year-old. My five-year-old was so excited today about coming and actually seeing me standing up front. And unfortunately, she woke up this morning with a sore throat, so I thought I would save all of your lovely children from having sore throats tomorrow morning. So she's at home with my husband at the moment. I've been involved with Hagar since 2003, and we set up Hagar Australia offices at the end of 2009, and that was when I started working for them. I'd been on the board prior to that and been volunteering for them. So I work 2 days a week, and we're based in Perth, and I feel really privileged and blessed to be able to essentially be a voice to the voiceless and be able to share the vision and mission of Hagar to the community in Australia. We have, I'd like to just give you, as already mentioned, some background on why it's called Hagar. It's funny because when I speak about Hagar, it's really easy to explain why we called Hagar to Christian communities. It's really difficult to explain to non-Christian communities. They think it stands for something, or they ask me if it's Hagar the Horrible. And so it's lovely when I get to actually tell the real story, or I still do it to the non-Christian community, but they don't necessarily get it as such. But understanding that Hagar, so it comes from the story in Genesis. So Abraham couldn't have a child. He has a child with Hagar, and she has a young boy, Ishmael. When Sarah decides to send them out into the desert, I'll read it to you, and then so it said, early the next morning, no, it won't start from there. So after they were sent out, early the next morning, Abraham gave Hagar an animal skin full of water and some bread. Then he put the boy on her shoulder and sent them away. They wandered around in the desert near Beersheba. And after they had run out of water, Hagar put her son under a bush. Then she sat down a long way off because she could not bear to watch him die, and she cried bitterly. When God heard the boy crying, the angel of God called out to Hagar from heaven and said, "Hagar, why are you worried? Don't be afraid. I have heard your son crying." And the story of Hagar, when Hagar first started in Cambodia in 1994, the founder said it was like he was hearing the cries. Hagar means one who flees, one who seeks refuge. And at Hagar, we are passionate about the ones who flee, the ones who seek refuge, the ones that are sent out and are crying out there. They may be starving, they may be abandoned, they may have been trafficked. And it's about those cries, and God hears those cries. And that's part of why we find the really love the name Hagar and just feel really privileged to be able to have that as the meaning behind our organization, one who flees, one who seeks refuge, and giving that opportunity to actually provide that refuge to them. Just as a basic overview as to what Cambodia is like at the moment, so you can understand, I guess, the need. You have 1 in 3 Cambodians live on less than $1 per day. Now, understanding that doesn't mean that for $1 a day, they're actually working 12 hours. Some of these, you'll see them up and down the streets, the people that go and actually street cleaners, they work 12, 14 hours a day, and they earn 50 cents a day. And so they're earning $15 a month. But one in three are less than $1. 68% are living on less than $2 a day. And again, understanding, well, how far does that money actually go? If you're renting an apartment, or a room in Cambodia in a just off the street area, like the first level housing you could get into, you'd be looking at a room that's probably 3 times the size of this table, and it would cost about $35 a month. So if you're earning $1 a day or $2 a day, there's just no way you can afford somewhere to live. So essentially you live on the streets, you live on the rubbish tips, and that's just the accommodation. So that's not food, that's not medical help for your children, that's not sending your kids to school because you have to pay if you want your child to go to school. So it's tough for them, and they just don't have those opportunities, which is why you can understand the poverty cycle continues. We also have 1 in 5 women aged 15 to 49 who've been married have experienced violence in their families. And domestic violence continues to be on the rise. Cambodian girls are trafficked to Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, and even as far as Saudi Arabia, Taiwan, and Korea for labour, sexual exploitation, and domestic servitude. There are even Cambodian children that are trafficked to Australia for domestic servitude and sexual exploitation. With the legalisation of brothels, it's obviously opened up a whole lot of doors because they need more people to work in those businesses. Cambodia also has one of the highest rates of human trafficking in the world. So at one stage they were estimating that 1,000 girls a month were getting trafficked outside of Cambodia. So we think that's 12,000 girls a year. That's just outside of Cambodia. That doesn't include the ones that are trafficked within. And it's estimated that 64% of the country's sex workers have been forced into prostitution. So they it's not like they voluntarily did it. They were actually sold into that or were underhandedly stolen and taken. So what do we do at Hagar? We have a mission statement. And our mission statement is whatever it takes for as long as it takes to restore a broken life. Now, if you actually think about that, that's a massive statement. Whatever it takes for as long as it takes to restore a broken life. Not three strikes, you're out. Not, oh, this is getting too hard. Maybe we'll just send you off and we'll deal with the easy cases. We deal with the tough cases. We do whatever it takes for as long as it takes to restore a broken life and restore that broken life to wholeness with our resilient members of community again. At Hagar, we don't do the rescues. We don't go out to the brothels and take the girls and do the G.I. Joe, cameras on the lapels out there. There are organizations that do that. We do the after rescue. We do the rehabilitation, which is the long process. It's the work from then onwards until they're able to be resilient. And we also don't go and do what other organizations already do. There are plenty of orphanages in Cambodia. We don't do the standard orphanages. There are organizations that do that. They do a great job. We look for where the gap is. And anytime we start a program or run any of our programs, we're looking for where the children and women are slipping through the gaps and nobody's doing anything about them. Those are the programs that we run and we work really hard on. Over 80% of the children that are in our care actually come from other organizations that have said they're too hard, we don't want to work with them. And these children would eventually actually end up back on the streets, repeat the same cycle as to why they came to being rescued. And so those are the children that we care for, so that to make sure that there's none of those ones that are falling through. We started in 1994 with a drop-in shelter where women could come. These are women that are being either abandoned, they're being abused by their husbands, the severe poverty. And the drop-in center started off where women could actually come and just get medical help, counseling, and we started a couple of businesses so that they could actually get a job and stand on their own two feet. Because obviously, if they don't have a job, if they don't have a means to make a living, they're reliant on their husbands, or they're caught up in that domestic violence situation where they can't leave because how do they support their children? There's no center link or anything else in Cambodia. One of the girls we had in our care, who's now actually our country director's PA, her name is Chandra, and she lived out in the community. Her family was very, very poor, and they couldn't afford to feed all the children. So when she was very young, they married her off to a young man in the village. From the moment she was married to him, he started abusing her. He used to rape her. He used to tie her up. He would tie her up for 2 days and leave her there, and he would go out. He would drink and gamble excessively. He used to beat her up. One particular time, he beat her up so badly that she lay unconscious on the floor. When she woke up in the morning, she realized that if she didn't leave, she was going to be dead. She had no options. She'd never, ever been to school one day in her life. She had no food, no money, nothing, but she knew she had to leave. She escaped from the community and she came down to Phnom Penh. When she was living on the streets in Phnom Penh, somebody told her about Hagar. And so she came to our drop-in center and came into our care. She's an amazing woman now. She talks about her story regularly. And as I say, she went through our Career Pathways program, which is their life skills and job readiness program, and got her into the workplace. She did her administration course, as I said, as our country director's PA, and is continuing to study as she wants to extend her skills and go on further. And this is a woman that would have been stuck in the community and abused for whoever knows how long, has now had the second chance, and it's really exciting to see that change and the opportunities that she's had and many others in the care. We also have the recovery shelter for girls that are trafficked for sex. When we first started this program, we were working with girls from about the age of 11 to 17. These are girls that either have been sold voluntarily by their parents, or otherwise someone goes into the community and says, oh, we're needing workers in restaurants, we're needing people to clean houses, will you send your daughter down to Phnom Penh? The daughter gets taken down, and suddenly when they arrive, the doors open and they're at no restaurant, they're actually at a brothel and they're tied up and kept there, and the parents never see them again. So those are the two ways how children actually end up in the brothels. And for the if you'd gone through Cambodia, the first time I went to Cambodia in 2003, you could see exactly where the brothels were. There were red lights, there were the girls outside. It was very obvious. But what was happening was a lot of these American G.I. Joe organisations were coming through, raiding the brothels, taking all the girls, and all of a sudden their business, there's nothing left of these people's business. And so what they do now is it's a lot more hidden. You don't see it as much. We saw it happen right in front of us last year when we were there. They now have the girls where if the parents have willingly sold the children, these children sometimes still live at home. So they're still expected to have a normal life and play in the streets and work in the family. But their photo's taken, a photo's taken of them. This photo sits in a flip file. There are other girls that are sold and kept in dungeons in brothels. And again, their photos are taken and kept in a flip file. And when somebody's after a girl, they get given this flip file. And this is what we saw happen right in front of us. This international pedophile came and he was bought by this relatively well-dressed Cambodian woman. They sat down at a table in a restaurant on the busy riverfront and he paged through this flip file. He selected the girls that he wanted. He then went back to his guest house. She sends the tuk-tuk driver to go and pick up these girls and these girls are then delivered to his guest house. So it's really hard to catch them in the act because there's not, you know, red lights sitting outside. It's you've got to catch them when they're actually with these men. Sometimes these men will have them for a day. Sometimes they may have them for 2 weeks. Sometimes they have them for longer periods of time. And then when they're finished, the tuk-tuk drivers come, pick them up and take them back to whether they're going back to their dungeons or whether they're just expected to go back and live normal lives after the trauma that has happened to them. As I was saying, these girls we were working with were 11 up at the moment. Now we've had to change our program. We're now working with girls from the age of 4. Because of the belief, fallacy, that if you have sex with a virgin, you'll be cured from a multiple of diseases or otherwise you're guaranteed you won't get HIV/AIDS, they look for them a lot younger. So it is very common now that they get sold from 4 to 6 is normally the beginning stages where they get sold by their parents. We have a girl who, Shanti is her name. She was rescued in 2003 in a very international raid. It was played all over the US. It was done by one of the American organisations where they went and they got her. She was 6 years old when her mum passed away and there were 4 of them in the family. And she lived out in the community, very poor. A aunt, friendly, kind aunt, I would say with inverted commas, came and said to the dad, look, you're dealing with the loss of your wife, you've got 4 children, you don't have money to care for these 4 children, let me take your 2 daughters. I'll take them down to Phnom Penh, they can work in a factory, they can send money home and it can help you. So the dad, dealing with his own sadness and trauma, he said, absolutely, you can take them. They went down to Phnom Penh and this aunt took them down to this brothel where they were each sold for $100. These girls were kept in brothels for 6 years before they were rescued. Shanti often tells a story about how the rooms that they were kept in were these little brick rooms. They were tiny. They were just bigger than the size of a single bed, with a door and a wooden number. They didn't even have a name. They were just labelled with their number and they would have men that would come and they would either select the number that they would go to or the men would just get directed to a particular number on the door. And she says she would have up to 6 men a night and this went on for 6 years for a young girl of 6. She came to us at Hagar and just obviously was the issues that she went through. Both her and her sister were rescued in this raid and were brought to us. She was really... had went through a lot of, as you can imagine, a lot of trauma and issues. I mean, if you went home today, you walked down past a bush and somebody raped you, you would have the issues of you would never feel safe, you would have night terrors, you'd lose that security, that sense of safety that you have. These are girls that for 6 years had it repeatedly done to them. But the amazing thing is they've come through our counselling program, and our counsellors are trained by Johns Hopkins University in the US, because in Cambodia, counselling means don't worry, love. Just smile and get over it and everything will be okay. And as we know, that doesn't solve it. And they never get that opportunity to repair themselves and get to that restoration of wholeness. And so she's come through our counselling program and she does extremely well. She's actually now wanting to study to be a counsellor and be part of our counselling group. She's 17 now. She is the first person, when the girls get brought to us in our recovery shelter, she's the first one that'll go and give them the hug. And because she knows exactly what it was like. We also have a program which was started in 2008. What was happening was when these girls were getting rescued, they they kept on saying, but there's boys. There's boys in this football. You know, it's not just girls that it's happening to. And in Cambodia, they don't believe that boys can be abused. They don't believe that boys can get raped. And so we looked into this side, and World Vision actually sponsored us to do a study on boys that are trafficked for sex in Cambodia. And when we did the study, we found out that not only were boys getting trafficked for sex, but there were equal amount of boys that were getting abused to girls, and yet it was just being left. So we started the first of its programs in Cambodia in 2008, and we opened our doors to our first group of boys that came through. We had a variety of children. Again, they started from very young ages of six, and we had 14 in our first group. And of these 14, we had two brothers. These two brothers had been sold by their mum to an international pedophile. When the man had had the boys with him, he was actually caught by the police, and the police took him to jail, and sent the boys back to the mum. He was an international pedophile. He obviously had money, especially compared to Cambodian dollars, and bribery is a standard business practice in Cambodia. So while he was in jail, he paid them off and they released him. He realized the only way that the court would drop the charges was if the mum dropped the charges against him. So he went to the mum and he said, I will give you $2,500 if you drop the charges. Now, understanding when they're living on $1 or $2 a day, $2,500 is a lot of money. So she dropped the charges and took the $2,500 cash. The next morning, these two boys woke up. They couldn't find their mum anywhere. And they went walking up and down the street, and they couldn't find her. They went to the aunt's house. She wasn't there. And when they were walking back, they saw this body lying on the ground. And as they picked it up, they saw it was their mum, and she'd had her throat slit. So whether it was the person who came and bought the money or whether somebody else in the community knew about the money, but the money was gone too. These two boys were brought to us at Hagar. Not only had they gone through this trauma of the rapes of this international pedophile, but they've now lost their mum. They are now sent to our care, and they're dealing with tough issues, really tough things. But again, they're doing amazingly well now. They're still in our care. They're still in our recovery shelter. They don't have a family that they can go back to. There are no safe members in their family who won't resell them. So we keep them, and we have our foster care facilities where they have foster mums. Just so you know, a lot of studies have been done on foster care, and they actually indicate that children going through foster care, it's actually not to their benefit, because when they get to the age of 17, they all of a sudden get released, or 18, released into the community. And they have never lived in community. They don't understand it. It's overwhelming. And often, in orphanages, when they open the doors and send the children out, the people that are waiting on the other side of the fence are brothel owners. And they'll say, come, come, I'll give you work, I'll give you work. Suddenly, they're back in the cycle where they were first rescued from in the beginning. So our care that we have, we actually have foster carers in the community where these children work in a family. So, sorry, when I use the word work, I mean, they're involved in family duties of helping cooking and cleaning. They go to school, but they're actually kept in community with parents so that they actually know how to live in community, so they're going to be more resilient when they get to that older stage. We also, and these two boys are actually in one of these family homes. We've also got, we had a little boy that was also in the first group. He had one leg shorter than the other, so he's classified as disabled in Cambodia. And this little boy used to be sold for $1.25 every time somebody used to rape him. So again, you can understand how you feel if your worth is $1.25. We also have a program which we started for children which are trafficked for labour. And as you can imagine, in Cambodia, when children are not worth a lot, you can sell them for very little and they get sent off. We have children that work on the rubbish tips, and they work there all day digging through rubbish, seeing what they can find that can be resold at markets or sold to other industries like recycling. We have a lot of children that get sold to brick kilns. Cambodian children are very small. They can fit into all the little gaps and grooves in these big brick kilns. And as you can imagine, if the child loses an arm or leg or dies in the process, they just literally get picked up, thrown outside with all the broken bricks, and they'll go and purchase another child. There are also children that are sold to the fishing industry in Thailand. So when you see your fish is bought from Thailand, who actually got that fish is the question you should be asking. These children are put onto boats, and again, if they get washed overboard, it doesn't matter. When they get back to shore, they'll just buy another child. And we also have children that are used for domestic servitude, so used for cleaning houses. We have a girl that was brought to us in 2009. Her name is Kalyan. She lived out in the community. When she was born, her mum didn't want her. A neighbour took her on and kept her until she was nine. And sorry, she was more Tasman, she was 11. When she was sold at 9, she was sold to this woman here. This woman is very high up in the education department. Her husband's very high up in the government officials. She bought Kalyan, and Kalyan would work 12, 14 hours a day in the house. Now, Kalyan right now is about 13, and she is still only about this big. So she would have been absolutely tiny at the age of 9 and expected to do this hard labor and hard work. This woman used to abuse her. She used to put her in washing baskets and put her in cupboards and close the door and leave her there for 2 days. She was also sexually abused by and raped by the husband. And this woman would take pliers, and you can see on her body where those scars are. And she used to take pliers and pluck skin out of her with these pliers. And the one, we can't obviously show the front of her, but on the shoulder up here, up there, she actually had so much skin that had actually been taken out and pliered that her bones, the whole area was just exposed. She had 4 breaks to her body when she came to us. The first thing they do is we obviously do a medical for all women and children that come into our care, and she had 2 broken wrists and 2 other breaks. All 4 breaks were done to her by this woman, and she was still expected to work while she had these breaks. When they come in on our counselling program, we measure them on their trauma versus resilience. So obviously when they come in, their trauma is very high, resilience is very low. And when they leave and get back into community, it obviously needs to be the other way around. Kalyan actually came in and she had the highest level of trauma that any child would ever had in our care. She would sit and someone would drop something off a table and she would just wet herself. It took her over 3 months before there was even the faintest look of a smile on her face. But she has been with us in our care, and Hagar, we have a law group that works with us, does pro bono work with us, so that we can ensure that justice is served, which is part of the healing for these children. And the amazing thing is this woman got 20 years jail and her husband got 16. So it was really exciting and really good, and it sent a good message into the community. We also have our community learning centre. This is a catch-up school, because remembering that these children often are never educated. Girls are not valued, so they don't get sent to school. They just get sold. All of a sudden, they get rescued, you know, and they may be 11 years old. And we obviously want to make sure to break that poverty cycle. We need to get them education so that they can move forward in life. And so we started a school, which is our Community Learning Centre catch-up school, where they can do 2 years in one. So when they arrive when they're 11, we would never put an 11-year-old in a standard year one classroom because they're not going to learn. They're not going to want to be there. It's pointless. So we started the school where they come in and they'll do years 1 to 6 in 3 years. So if they come to us, say, when they're 10 or 11, they can actually be passing year 6 when they're 13, 14, and then going on to high school. We're associated with other high schools where they go on to, and we also have university scholarships so they can continue their studies the whole way through. We had our curriculum that we run at the school has been approved by the government, and they do a test at the end of grade 6. To say that they've actually passed the grade 6 level, and we have wonderful success. Last year we had 100% pass rate of these children that can actually go through. Now, understanding it's not just as these children are learning during these 6 years in 3, they're dealing with everything else, the trauma, the counselling, the medical support and everything else that they have. So it really shows the amazing job that they're doing, that these children can come through all of this plus study and be able to move on, and 100% success rate. We have a young girl in our care at the Community Learning Centre. Her name is Lee, and this was only December last year, she was out in the community and she was fishing by one of the lakes, and when she was there, a neighbour saw her, and he went up to her and he proceeded to rape her. She started screaming, she's 13, she started screaming, and her 11-year-old brother heard her screams and he came to her help. This guy had a knife with him, he took the knife and he slit the brother's throat and left him dying on the ground. As he continued to rape her, when he finished raping Lee, he took the knife and he stabbed her repeatedly in her abdomen and stomach to hide the rape and in the hope that she would actually die. He then ran off. The community had heard the screams, and by this stage they called the police, and the police called Hagar, and we went down to pick her up. And this young girl had to go straight into surgery. She will never be able to toilet herself. She'll never have children. She's got a whole lot of physical issues, as well as obviously the mental trauma. The mum has lost a son who was there being a hero, rescuing her, and has had to deal now with what's happened to her daughter. She can't go back into community because people will blame the daughter for what happened. So they have to relocate this whole family, all because this guy decided to rape her. Rape in the community is on the increase. And again, sadly, it's happening a lot more with very little children. So when people are going off to work and they're leaving their children with neighbours, suddenly the children go missing. They either get taken to brothels or otherwise they get gang raped. So the security side, those sorts of issues are just continuing on the rise. And they're big issues and big, a large amount of work for Hagar, but just really special when you get to see the hope and the help that these people actually do get. We also have our last thing, is our children with disabilities. And this is a really exciting section that we're doing at the moment. In 2008, the government in Cambodia decided that children with disabilities were entitled to an education. Now, this may seem absolutely bizarre that it took them so long to realise that, but it's wonderful that they did. And so the government schools freaked out and said, oh, we find it hard enough dealing with all these kids in the classroom as it is, let alone dealing with special needs. So they rang Hagar and they said, if we give you a classroom and we'll give you the teacher and the teacher assistant, will you please do the children with disabilities? So of course Hagar said, absolutely. So we started the first group of these classrooms. The government school, this is one of the classrooms in the government schools that they give to us. So we go in there and it looks like that. After we've done so, we have groups that come over and they help us do it up. It costs about $8,500 to do it, but it also, the majority of the costing is actually the disabled toilets. So making sure there's ramps into the classrooms and disabled toilets for these children. So it looks like that when the kids come in. That's what a classroom looks like with the children. So you can see we've got the teacher here. We've got the teacher assistant at the back there. And then what we also do is we get parents to come in and we pay these parents to come in and actually work in the classrooms, because obviously if they're coming in and helping and they're not earning an income, it's not helping anything. So we give them money to be there, and there's two reasons why. One, they're obviously getting an income so that they have money for their family, but the second reason is that they get to see that their children can learn. Their children can be valued members of society and community. And the amazing thing is when we first started this, the first year we did this, we actually had five children that actually got mainstreamed into the mainstream, put into the mainstream classrooms, because they were learning so well. And these would have been children that would have been locked up in houses while the parents worked. Because in Cambodia, if I had a disabled child and I was selling fruit and veg at the market, nobody would buy my fruit and veg because they would believe that whatever disease my child had is contagious, and if they buy my fruit and veg, they'll end up the same way. So these children used to just get locked up and kept away from society or sold, because obviously in the begging industry, a disabled child is going to get a lot more than a non-disabled child. So it's really exciting to see these wonderful opportunities now that these children with disabilities have in Cambodia. We have an early learning centre, which is also part of when the mums are coming through the Career Pathways program and they're studying and getting their job readiness skills. They were getting very concerned about where their children were. They didn't want to leave them with neighbours because they'd get stolen or raped. So we started an early learning centre where the children come, they get their meals for the day. It's a wonderful education. They start all the way up to year five, and it's peace of mind for these mums as they're working so that they don't have to worry about where their children are. And it runs really well. It's right by the shelter where the women are. I'd like to just share as a brief account of a story or an account that I read. In the Bible, it says it talks about poverty over 2,100 times. And I think it's something that we often forget about, God's passion for the poor. And there's this an account of a guy who started one of those Christian courses, famous Christian courses that people go to learn about Christianity. And he was going down the beach one day on his bicycle and he bumped into a Christian leader. And the Christian leader said to him, "Ah, so tell me about this course that you started." And this guy said, "Well, you know, it's all about the basics of Christianity and teaches about Christianity." So this Christian leader said, "Ah, so it talks about the poor, it talks about the needy, it talks about the people with HIV/AIDS. And he said, no. It's just the basics of Christianity. And it's funny how often we forget that it was the poor and needy that Jesus would spend his time with. And it's those are the ones that should be the passions of our hearts, the ones that we should really be focusing, be reminded that that's what being a Christian is all about. And so as I close, I'd like to say thank you so much. There's been members of the church that have been involved in Hagar and have helped us, because we would never be able to do any of this without the support of people, and we wouldn't want to do it without the support of people. We love having people with us that share the journey with us, that walk with us with the Kalyans as they go through court, that walk with us with the Lees, and get to see that end process where they actually get to be restored and back into community. And I'd just like to say thank you. Oh, sorry, questions? I forgot about that. Questions, yes. Yep.
Why? And yes, you can say poverty. Yes, you can say deprivation. But why is there so little regard for human life?
Yep. One of the reasons is there's no value for girls in Cambodia. So they have a belief that girls don't reach nirvana in their belief system. So because they don't have an afterlife, they're not valued on earth. So they're just there for the use and abuse of anyone. And that's one of the reasons why there's no value for girls. It's also in Asian culture, obviously, there's more value for the boys. And there's the poverty cycle. And one of the key main reasons why there's such a poverty issue in Cambodia is after the Pol Pot regime came through and they wiped out all the educated people, there just wasn't infrastructure or the economic side where people can get jobs. And so if you've got four children and these four children you're all starving and someone offers you $500 for one, they end up going, they sacrifice the one for the masses, and they tend to do that. The other thing which really irritates me is when I hear people say, but it's the oldest profession in the world. And it really bugs me because it's not a profession. It's the oldest paid abuse in the world, but they call it a profession to make it okay. People will say, but that's okay, that's what they always have done, that's just the way it is. The mums did it, they sell their children, and unfortunately we do. We've actually got one family in our care at the moment that all three girls were sold when they turned 6 years old by their mum. Every single time she would sell them, and she was sold herself. But the great thing is that now the cycle breaks because these three girls are no longer kept in that cycle. They now have an opportunity to break that cycle. And unfortunately, there are a lot of cases where it actually was done to the parents. And I don't understand when it's been done to you, how you could actually do it to your own child because you know what it was like. But it's funny how quickly that cycle and abuse, and look at any abusive cycle, it does continue on down the generations. But it's exciting now to actually see that by having these sorts of programs, it's actually that opportunities now to break that cycle. That next generation in Cambodia, we're hoping and believing that there will be a change, that there will be a cultural shift, and there will be people that are educated that will go, no, I am not going to sell my child. This is not okay. So there's a lot of different issues as to why they do it. And I guess it's just trying to find the ways to break those cultural beliefs and break those generational things that they do and making them realise that it's not okay. And unfortunately, though, it's also from when Cambodia first had the democratic elections in 1994, there were 1,000 prostitutes in Cambodia. There are now 55,000. And a lot of that is, and as I said, almost 70% of them, or 64% of them, are involuntary. And a lot of that is because of international tourism. And so as the internet increases and there's horrendous stories about what international pedophiles do when they go to Cambodia and they leave and they go home and they somehow justify it, I don't know how, but they justify what they do, and it's that international tourism that's actually sparking it and sending it through the roof. Yes?
How prevalent is HIV?
In Cambodia? It's very, very high. Fortunately, we haven't actually had a lot of cases of children in our care. There are organisations that work with the HIV AIDS children, and it's actually more the husbands, because men frequent brothels all the time in Cambodia. We've actually got one guy who works for us in our offices, and he's seen as strange by his friends, because when they go out, after they've gone out, all the men then go to brothels afterwards, and he goes home to his wife and little child, and they all think he's odd. And so what happens is these men pick it up in the brothels, bring it home to their wives. And so that's often the case where you have the husband and wife die and these children are orphaned. So there's a lot of those sorts of cases. But unfortunately, in the brothels, I actually don't know the statistics offhand, but HIV/AIDS is, again, massively on the increase. And again, it's why they're going for the younger girls, because when these international pedophiles are coming through, they know that they've got to be jolly careful because they're going to go home with something they weren't expecting, and that's why they buy the really little four-year-olds. Yeah.
What's the relationship between Hagar and Tia these days?
My understanding was that Tia still supports us. They just support through Hagar International, not through Hagar Australia offices. Right. So
is Tia still supporting projects in Cambodia?
Yes. Yes, Harvey Collins would be better answering that because I work with the Hague Australia offices. Yeah. I don't work with the funds that go directly there. I think TIER's obviously got other initiatives that they're following down the way, so I don't think it's as large as it was before. So, but I mean, we're still very connected. World Vision is, they're wonderful supporters of us, actually. Yeah. Yes.
Are the programs just based in Phnom Penh or are you in North Cambodia and other rural areas?
Yes, we have people on the borders because what happens is when people are trafficked to Thailand or those bordering areas, what they do is Thailand, for example, picks up the children and then takes them to the border. They stay in jail for a night and then they get let out and they don't get sent anywhere. So, of course, who's sitting at the borders is all the brothel owners. So they pick all these girls up and the process continues. So we've got people on the borders, so when these girls get bought, we make sure we either direct them to us at Hagar or otherwise they go on to other organisations. But they come, so it makes sure that there isn't that continuing cycle. We also have people out in the community and church pastors. They keep us aware because we have, at the moment, we've got a little girl who's 5 who the mum's trying to sell. And so we've got the pastor who's keeping us in the loop as to what's happening. We've actually got her in our care at the moment, but the mum wants her back because she's been offered $750 for her. And so the pastors in communities often let us know, look, you know, I've heard that, you know, this child's going to be sold. You need to come down and, you know, hit that cycle, hit it before it actually happens. Try and get them in our care to make sure the prevention cycle. So we have that within Cambodia community, but our main offices are based in Phnom Penh. We're also connected with 42 businesses in Phnom Penh, where when the women come and do our Career Pathways program, they have a choice, so they don't just get told you have to work in a garment factory. They can actually choose their line of work, so they'll want to study, want to work and do really well, and we help them set up businesses in the communities too. We're also, Cambodia is also based in Vietnam and Afghanistan as well, and we work with similar cases again of abuse and trafficking in both of those areas too. Yes?
Do you have any high-profile
that work with us?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Not organisations, I'm talking about
wealthy individuals. No. No, we don't. Obviously, always something you look for, but normally you need them to approach. It's not as easy to approach them. Yep. I do have information. There's some information there. Our latest newsletter is there. We've got other information about Hagar. We've also got the lady who runs our Career Pathways program, Tatiana Klein, is coming to Perth in June. We're doing a breakfast relating to Career Pathways, so we've also got that event coming up if you're interested. And if you do ever have any questions, Ken has got and Trish has got my email address, my phone number, so feel free to contact me, and I'm always happy to talk.